We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No Maria this week. She has had a brutal week at work and is sleeping while we record.
Yes, so. At least we certainly hope she's sleeping.
Yeah. Getting started with local, and last week we noted the passing of a couple different people.
Yeah, one of whom was Lonnie Guinier, who was briefly Surgeon General under Bill Clinton in the early 90s.
No, she was really... Lonnie Guinier wasn't Surgeon General. She was...
Oh, I'm sorry, Jocelyn Elders. I did it again, see? I've got a block on it. You know, women of color who were thrown under the bus by Bill Clinton. I'll take that for 400. Yeah, so I mixed them up. Lonnie Guinier passed last week. She was actually nominated to be the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, for which she was well qualified, but that was why the Republicans threw a fit and blocked her nomination, and then Bill Clinton threw her under the bus because he was the first black president, quote unquote. That was sarcasm, by the way. So, I mixed that up with Jocelyn Elders. My apologies. So, anyway, yes, moving on. That does happen, and we do try to correct mistakes when they happen, and when one or the other of us is speaking extemporaneously and goof something up. So, it does happen. Not very often, but it does happen.
All right. So... also wanted to note this week the passing of longtime local activist and raging granny Shirley Morrison.
Oh no, I had not heard about that.
Yeah, she was like a.
Oh, I knew Shirley. Of course, many people knew Shirley. So
yeah, she was a fixture here at, you know, like practically every event I ever went to.
For at least the last 30 years, yeah, and. Yeah. Yeah, she was the mother-in-law of Joe Swaya, another prominent local activist. And, she was great. She's a very, very solid person.
Yeah, and a raging granny. So we have a lot of their performances archived over the years. And aired on former radio station I used to be on. And she will be greatly missed.
Yes, very much so. I had not heard about that. That's very sad. I mean, she was getting up there in years, but still.
She made it to 100, I think.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I thought she might be in her 90s, but I wasn't sure. Okay.
At least that's what I read on Facebook.
Okay. Well, as you know, everything you read on the internet is accurate. So.
Exactly. Well, let's move on. Wanted to touch on before we got a ton of COVID related news this week. But we did talk last week about the Seattle Police Department's radio dispatch disinformation campaign that occurred on June 8th, 2020.
Yes. And there were a few updates on that this week, I understand.
Yes. So City Council had their safety committee meeting on Tuesday of this week, and Lisa Herbold was the person in charge, and that was also the first item on their list for that meeting. And Andrew Meyerberg, the head of the OPA, the director of OPA, was present, and he fielded a bunch of questions in a very limited amount of time. One thing that he mentioned that I thought was interesting, he was talking about whether they were talking about it as a ruse, and his response at one point was, quote, one thing I think it's important to note is that we use the ruse policy because it was the best fit for this case. But really, this isn't a true ruse. Really, this is a misinformation, disinformation campaign. I think the closest policy is the ruse, and that's why we evaluated under the ruse policy.
Specifically, disinformation. Misinformation means you don't understand it and you get it wrong. disinformation means you're trying to deceive, and that's what was going on here.
So it sounds like they're going to look into things further. At least that is what the city...
Who's they? OPA or they, city council?
Well, city council is pushing for further looking into the situation.
Okay, good.
And it sounds like even Mayor Harrell is interested in pursuing looking into this further. He actually used the word lies during his press conference.
Yeah, that's accurate, too.
Yeah. What was truly amazing to me was that following later that day, this is Tuesday, later that day, following Meyerberg's talk before city council, the Harrell administration made the announcement that Mr. Meyerberg would have a new role in the Harrell administration as the new public safety director. So what
is a public safety director? I've not heard this title before.
Well, I think they just, you know, made it up, kind of like they, as mayors do when new mayors come in, they just make new positions and add a long list of deputy mayors and whatever the heck they want to do. So it sounds like he's just going to be a liaison. Actually, that was brought up at the press conference. Bruce Harrell didn't actually want to call it. He literally said he didn't want to call it a liaison position, but essentially he's just going to be helping the Harrell administration navigate the different issues that are going to be coming up, you know, with the police.
Well, so, there are quite a few of those. They need to pick a new police chief. Adrian Diaz is an interim chief after Carmen Best left in late 2020. Diaz has been there in the interim role for over a year because Durkin didn't want to be responsible for a new chief. So Harrell has inherited that problem. And also the union contract with SPOG needs to be renegotiated. That will be coming up this year as well. So there's going to be a lot on the plate, you know, plus all of the usual problems with SPD. And, you know, the Durkin administration tried very hard to wrap up the federally administered reform process, but she was unsuccessful in that because the federal judge that was overseeing that process, you know, rejected the proposed SPOG contract under Durkin's administration. So, you know, that's all connected, and yeah, they're going to be busy for sure.
So Wednesday, and we'll get to your talk on the other subject that they covered. The two subjects during the press conference of Bruce Harrell on Wednesday was the moratorium and the ruse. He was calling it a ruse originally. So during the Q&A segment on talking about the ruse, SPD chief Adrian Diaz was responding to a question talking about the investigation. He said that 90% of the answers regarding the disinformation campaign are knowable because the answers reside within current officers at SPD and former officers at SPD. The reason why it's not knowable is because they haven't been forthcoming with the information, end quote. And right after that, City Council member Lisa Herbold responded, and I think the question of whether or not the answers that we are receiving are truthful answers is another legitimate question.
Well, that clears things up.
I mean, at least it shows that both the current chief of police, the head of the public safety committee for City Council, seem somewhat in sync with that SPD has not been forthcoming with information about this issue.
Okay, boys and girls, the object lesson out of this whole sordid story is that cops lie. Just remember that the next time you interact with one. They lie for a living. They're very good at it. And sometimes they can't break the habit when it's appropriate for them to break that habit and be forthcoming.
So I just thought it was interesting context to, you know, add to the fact that it appears that there might be further investigation on the city's part into this issue.
Yeah, and I want to use that incident as context and the whole incident. Remember the ruse being to You know, we played this last week on the show, and it was really useful to hear it. Faked radio chatter that the Proud Boys were approaching the CHOP racial equity protest on Capitol Hill. And there was another story out of Portland yesterday, and I want to mention it here because it's important context for SPD as well. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced that the internal investigation had found that the Portland Police Bureau had been using, I guess, as a PowerPoint or a slideshow, the last slide of which after, you know, an hour presentation or whatever it is, and this is a training course for officers, right, for potential officers, was a graphic on how to brutalize dirty hippies, in other words, protesters. This had been inserted sometime 2017, 2018, you know, after Trump administration's DOJ had stopped investigating local police agencies. And the only reason that, that Seattle still has oversight from the DOJ is that our reform process goes back to Obama. Actually, it nearly goes back to the first term of Obama. It's that old. You know, the question then, this locally in Portland, of course, this explains a lot about why Portland became the epicenter of post George Floyd murder protests in 2020 in the United States. They were much more radical than they were anywhere else. Not only was the Trump administration keen on trying to, provoke protesters, but so were the local police. And of course, the response of local protesters was to protest more because, of course, the George Floyd murder is literally a protest about police violence and police brutality and police use of force. And, you know, there was plenty of that in 2020 in Portland. I'm sure we all remember the scenes of all the tear gas and all the different munitions that were used. It's not surprising that Portland police were trained to literally to brutalize protesters, who they viewed as dirty hippies, which is a very right-wing meme. And that part of this investigation also showed that the police were very cozy with the local Proud Boys. And this was another factor in the very combustible stew that was Portland in 2020. And it's parts of 2021 as well. So that raises the question, of course, since the SPD approach to the protests outside the East Precinct was pretty similar, really, for the first week and a half or so of the protests, 2 weeks before they abandoned the East Precinct. We've already had the revelation this week about the fake radio chatter and the OPA sustaining that complaint. And the city, of course, has also settled a number of lawsuits protesters have filed against the city for the use of unprovoked force by SPD during that time period. So how exactly are SPD officers being trained, formally or informally? I mean, Portland has had, complaints with protesters and, use of force by police when it wasn't justified going back literally decades. And the same is true of SPD. Is this just an informal thing within the culture of SPD, or has it been formalized? Is it on a slide somewhere? Is it in a training manual? I think that's a legitimate question to ask given what we found out about Portland yesterday.
Yeah, I just remembered another item that related to the SPD's disinfo campaign was that the day of, hours before, about 6:30 p.m., that there was emails sent out to the Office of Emergency Management talking about potential Proud Boys activity in different parks happening there. So it wasn't just, I mean, that wasn't happening in isolation, what the SPD.
Right.
So in other words, it wasn't even very imaginative what they tried to pull off.
Well, and there was layers. I mean, it became clear from that email that there was multiple departments within the city that were being alerted to this, and that, you know, that resources were and people were being focused on that specific
sure.
issue.
And I remember that week that there was a lot of concern about Proud Boys coming down. Remember, I think it was the previous day where an apparently lost motorist drove into the protest.
Right.
And people at first were thinking, oh, this might be a right-wing thing. It turned out not to be, but that threat was very much top of mind for people.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Something to keep following up on.
All right. Other piece of news coming out of, or at least related to the Seattle Police Department this week.
Yeah. We got the announcement yesterday from Chief Diaz that SPD was no longer going to enforce minor violations. In other words, they're not going to pull you over if you're not wearing a bike helmet or if your tags are expired. You know, they might give you a ticket if there's something else that you do that alerts them or gets their attention, but they're not going to enforce things that by themselves pose no threat to other people, is what Diaz said. So, I think that's relatively good news. You know, anytime SPD is denied a pretext for pulling somebody over, that's all to the good, since, you know, pretext stops like that tend to be disproportionately enforced against people of color, the poor, et cetera. And in particular parts of town that SPD is targeting. So, hopefully that's a move to the positive. We'll see if how it plays out.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much tracking that gets.
Yep.
I know that getting pulled over for expired tabs is a major reason for a lot of police interactions with motorists.
And we've seen in different parts of the country where people wind up getting shot for traffic stops like that.
Yeah.
One less interaction with people who don't need to be interacted with.
Yeah. The other two items that are now considered low risk and not to engage motorists about are cracked windshields and items hanging from a rearview mirror.
Yeah, and we saw Dante Wright in Minnesota getting shot over a traffic stop for something hanging from a rearview mirror. That's why he was stopped. So, that's all to the good. And I remember when I was young and I was pulled over by a cop for a cracked windshield, and it was not a pleasant interaction, let's put it that way.
No. I had the same thing when something was hanging from the rearview mirror. So those stupid laws affect us all.
Yes, they do.
Disproportionately. So, all right, let's move on to, we touched on it just for all of 2 minutes last week, the weekly COVID updates that we had missed for several weeks due to the fact that we were doing end of year wrap ups.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to try and summarize the last one other than to say that
just
Omicron is running rampant in the U.S. We actually topped 1 million new cases one day, I think last week, and it's still very high, and deaths are very high as well. We're seeing hospitals being overwhelmed. The Washington Hospital Association has said something like 25% of Washington hospitals are at capacity because of COVID patients. If you think about it, the fact that the numbers of new infections are so high, even though Omicron is milder, if you have, say 10% of 10,000 new cases, you know, so you've got 1,000 people hospitalized as opposed to, 30% of a third of that is about the same. So the fact that we've got so many new infections, I'm not explaining this very well, means that hospitals are being overwhelmed, even though, for most people, the cases will be milder. The other thing that hospitals are running into is their staff are getting infected and have to self-quarantine or stay at home and stay away from work. So they're getting short-staffed. And we're seeing this also with schools. Local schools were largely closed yesterday because of a shortage of staff, because people were out sick. Several local high schools were closed. Schools on the east side were closed. The Seattle School District is talking about going to remote learning because they simply can't keep up with staff for learning, in person. The idea here being that if you have a teacher who has to self-quarantine, they can still instruct online, but they can't instruct in person, obviously. And so, a number of high schools, as I said, and all levels of K-12 really, are being affected by this. We're seeing this also in the supply chain with ordinary goods. Anybody who's done grocery shopping in the last week or two has noticed, how hard it is to find a lot of stuff. Even online, it's hard to find it. Amazon is widely out of stock of grocery items, at least. Mm-hmm. And this is a supply chain kind of thing because, the truckers and the railroad engineers and, every level of the transportation system and the supply chain, people were out sick from Omicron. So this is starting to affect the economy in a very serious way.
That was exacerbated too with the week of bad weather that we had. Trucks were not delivering, also due to ice conditions.
Yes, and in the past week, the East Coast has been hit by a succession of storms that have basically generated the same kind of problems back east. So it's that time of year, and climate change and the pandemic, two great taste great together.
Another contributing factor is there really sounds like they're pushing currently for people switching to N95 masks as opposed to the standard cloth masks because of how easily the Omicron seems to be able to infect
yes.
people.
N95 and KN95. There are two different types of masks. One of them is kind of circular and conical, and the other kind is the simple cloth mask will not stop Omicron. The idea is to wear an N95 or a KN95 and then put a cloth mask on top of it. So you want a double layer. That's what's being recommended now for protection when you're out in public, regardless of your vaccination status. So if you've been vaccinated, and boosted, keep wearing masks in public because you have no idea how communicable the person next to you might be. And that's outdoor settings as well as indoor settings. And, indoor settings are basically a bad idea at this point. Mm-hmm. We reached 10,000 deaths in Washington State last week. So that happened. And there were several important governmental actions locally and nationally this week. Bruce Harrell extended the eviction moratorium for the city of Seattle for another month, I believe through February 15th. So that was good news. It wasn't at all clear that he would do that. And Jay Inslee has done several things. He's mobilized the state National Guard. He's sending them to hospitals in Everett, Spokane, Wenatchee, and Yakima in order to supplement missing staff in those hospitals. And he also issued an emergency order to temporarily restrict non-urgent healthcare services like, optional surgeries and procedures that can be rescheduled for later. So that really speaks to how strained the healthcare system in Washington State is right now. And Washington State has actually not been hit nearly as hard as some other parts of the country, particularly California and Northeast. So, you know, it's bad here. It's certainly worse than it's ever been here, but it is not as bad as it is in some other parts of the country. And for that, we can be thankful, I guess.
Jumping back to masks for a second.
Sure.
I believe both King County Council and Governor Inslee announced that they would be both purchasing and distributing masks, as well as I thought they'd also talked about tests.
Yes. The masks and the tests will both arrive next week, I think. I forget what the allocation is for Washington State. But that was one of the things that happened nationally as Joe Biden announced that the federal government was going to buy and distribute another 500 million tests. So they're looking at an average of, I think, 4 tests per household that will be distributed free. And you can order them. There's a federal website that's being set up. I don't have that in front of me, but they're, you know, you can Google it and find out. That website will be active, I believe, on Monday, and you can start ordering then. So it's important to get the home tests. They're easy. They're free. And it helps you determine, even if you're not symptomatic, but if you think you might have been exposed, you know, check yourself. And if you discover that you have been exposed, you know, isolate yourself for 5 days if you're not symptomatic, or 5 days after you have been symptomatic if you are symptomatic, because you don't want to keep spreading it to other people. And you ideally don't want to spread it to other people in your family by not knowing you're infected. So,
And didn't the CDC change that? Originally it used to be 10 days, and didn't during – sometime between Delta and Omicron, didn't they, from business pressure, move it back to just 5 days?
Yeah, they moved it back. Actually, it was only about 3 weeks ago, I think, that they moved it back. And they got a lot of criticism for that from some public health experts who felt like they were, you know, caving to business pressure to try to keep people in their workplaces when they shouldn't be in their workplaces. And, of course, we're seeing now a lot of people who can't be in their workplaces. So, you know, but they can return more quickly than they used to be able to. There is science behind that change of guidance because Omicron, the incubation period is much shorter in Omicron than it was in Delta or any of the previous variants to where they think – you know, you're going to be shedding virus most in the first 3 days or so of infection, which is much more rapid than Delta was. That's one reason why Omicron has spread much more quickly, because, you know, the life cycle is quicker. So there is science behind it, but yeah, there was a lot of unseemly business pressure. And I mentioned this, I think last week, that the CDC's messaging and its changing guidances in the last 3 or 4 weeks has just been disastrous. It's been very unclear. And, you know, I understand that the scientific understanding of how Omicron works, it's a very, very different variant from the previous ones. That's literally been, we've been getting new studies every day. I mean, I do the social media, updates, of course, several times a week, and I'm getting people sending me medical papers every day with you know, new understanding of how Omicron works or what the experience was in the UK or South Africa or wherever. You know, there's just a ton of new information coming in, and the CDC is sifting through all that and then issuing new guidances. The problem is that their messaging on the guidances has just been terrible. And Dr. Walensky, the head of the CDC, is not a skilled public messenger, unfortunately. I mean, she's gotten a lot of heat, for instance, for an interview she did, I believe it was a week ago, 2 weeks ago yesterday, where she was talking about how, you know, the cases were milder, there weren't as, the death rate was down, and that was really good news that fewer people were dying. But the way she said it made it sound like it was good news that people were dying, that vulnerable people were dying, that people with comorbidities, or people who are, you know, disabled or have immunosuppression or immunocompromised statuses. And I fall in that category. And, you know, it's like, it's not good news if I die. I'm sorry. I don't think it is anyway. So a lot of disability groups, advocacy groups were giving her, a lot of, criticism over that. But yeah, their public messaging has just been terrible. But they're trying to follow the science. At least they're doing that. The public messaging around COVID for the first year of the pandemic, they weren't following science at all. They were just, you know, Republican death cult. They were trying to, get people to drink bleach. So that reminds me of a couple of the anti-vax groups, made a lot of headlines this past week. One of them was talking about, well, you know, if ivermectin doesn't work, we have some additional recommendations for things you can take. You can take a combination of Prozac and a class of drugs that is used to feminize in transgender healthcare. I really don't think the evangelical right would approve of that, but apparently that's what it was. But that's more palatable than the other alternative remedy, which is to drink your own urine. Now, this is actually not new. This is a thing in homeopathy, and has been for a number of years. It comes out of, I think, South Asia originally, but it is not. It does not kill viruses. I'm sorry, it just doesn't. So, do not drink your own urine if you think that's going to help with. Actually, don't do it anyway. Number one. Nobody will want to kiss you. Number two, it's disgusting. So, it's just not going to work. Anyway, that's a tangent, of course, because we're good at that on this show.
Yeah.
We also had the beginning of the state legislature this week, and five state senators promptly tested positive. And then nationally, a lot happened this week. We had the Supreme Court ruling on, I believe, Thursday that struck down the Biden administration's vaccine mandate by a 6-3 margin. All six conservatives on the court saying that OSHA did not have the authority to force major employers of 100 or more people to require vaccines of their workforce. That would have affected about 86 million Americans, and probably more than that, because there's an add-on effect where, you know, once somebody in a family gets vaccinated and discovers that it's really not that bad, maybe other people in the same family will get vaccinated. You know, the estimation that would be a large chunk of the unvaccinated population of the United States. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen now, and that Supreme Court ruling is going to cost probably, I would guess, tens of thousands of lives, literally, by people not, because the vaccine mandates work. We saw a report from United Airlines this week, for instance, which is one of the first major corporations to require its workforce be vaccinated, and they say that 3,000 of their employees have gotten infected. But of those currently, none are hospitalized and none have died, which is remarkable. That's what happens when you take vaccines. They work. I should mention also that we were talking about sectors of the economy that were affected. Airlines, it's a big sector. You know, we've seen a lot of flight cancellations because all of the major airlines have a lot of people out sick. Not surprising. Mm-hmm. So that was one Supreme Court ruling. There was a second, less noticed Supreme Court ruling that upheld HHS's ability to require healthcare workers be vaccinated in healthcare facilities, hospitals, clinics, long-term care facilities, et cetera, where that receive Medicare money, which of course is almost all of them. So that was good news that at least healthcare workers have to be vaccinated. It's a smaller pool of people, but you know, they're obviously dealing with very vulnerable sick people all the time. So and there is remarkably enough, there is a pool of healthcare workers that has refused to get vaccinated. A lot of them live in Texas, I guess. But
I think there was a good number here in Washington State too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was kind of joking because they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Washington State is actually really a national hub for anti-vaccine, the traditional anti-vaccine movement that is, you know, really morphed over the last year and merged with right-wing conspiracy theorists. It's very unfortunate. But we do have a lot of people in the state who refuse to get vaccinated, in King County even. I actually tried reading the court decisions from the Supreme Court because I really don't understand the grounds on which they struck it down. They said that OSHA did not have authority to require vaccinations of employers, but HHS does. OSHA is a division of HHS, so I'm not sure what the difference is between those two cases, and I have not seen a good explanation of what the difference is. What kind of distinction they were drawing there, because, you know, OSHA literally has the charge of workplace and worker safety. There was some kind of rationale on because the virus isn't strictly a workplace issue, it's not OSHA's purview to try and regulate prevention of it. But, explosions are not strictly a workplace issue either. But they happen in workplaces, and so OSHA tries to prevent them, right? Any other kind of worker safety issue like that. So I don't see why it would not apply in this case, the protecting against a virus. Because, as we know, indoor settings with not necessarily good ventilation, that describes a large percentage of workplaces in the United States, and as a result, those are prime areas for spreading the virus. And it would be very helpful if you could mitigate that by making sure people were vaccinated. And we have seen, as with the United Airlines case, people who refuse to get vaccinated, they threaten to quit their jobs. But what we've seen in corporations like United and Tyson's, and municipal employers and so forth that have enacted workplace, Washington State is another example, where the percentage of people who actually quit their jobs because they don't want to get vaccinated is relatively small, thank goodness. People aren't that stupid. So
it seems like perhaps a parallel would be, and I don't know if OSHA regulates this or not, but it seems like requiring people to wear hard hats in construction areas and or, warehouses and stuff would be.
Absolutely. That is an OSHA thing. Yes, okay. It is. I actually, in a previous life, I worked for OSHA for several years. So I taught preventive medicine and industrial hygiene in petrochemical plants in Houston. True story.
Yeah. Do you actually get a badge at that job?
Well, yeah, and if the badge turns colors, get out of there.
Okay.
Anyway, don't lick the side of the tanks, please. So that was one item. We mentioned Biden ordering 500 million more at-home tests. Those will start to be delivered next week. And then there was this little notice thing that was actually issued on the 6th, which is a convenient day to issue something you don't want to get a lot of media attention, that HHS listed in its roster of things that hospitals need to report to the federal government, it had a whole range of things that you no longer need to list because, you know, the requirements of tracking Omicron are different than they were for Delta. And so they're starting to adjust for that. But one of the things that it told hospitals not to report to the federal government was deaths. And I can't figure out why that has not been a major story. Maybe hospitals are still reporting to the CDC, but the CDC is under HHS, so why wouldn't that apply? We're still going to find out about deaths because every state tracks them. But, you know, I worry that if the federal government isn't tracking them, you have to go to multiple places to get a snapshot of how the nation is doing as a whole. And we've already seen states like Florida, report deaths like once a week because they don't want people paying attention to it. Ohio is like that, too. And so, you know, red states would have every incentive to simply not report deaths. So that's something to keep an eye on. I have not seen that recovered anywhere. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree and there's something about the bureaucracy that I'm not understanding. If any listeners are more familiar with it, please feel free to educate me.
I saw it on Twitter. There was some heated debate going back and forth that wasn't particularly illuminating overall.
I saw that debate as well.
It's a very dry topic, you know.
Yeah, it is. It wasn't very clarifying, that debate. Let's put it that way. The other item that I wanted to mention under national COVID news was that we try to do this once a show. We had some good news. Omicron appears to be peaking in places where it arrived earlier than it arrived here, Southern Africa and the UK in particular. And then also cities in the United States where it arrived first, and they had major outbreaks, Cleveland, Newark, Washington, D.C. They are falling, infection rates are falling rapidly now. That's very good to see. And we're starting to see plateaus and maybe starting to early signs that it might be falling in Chicago, New York City, Puerto Rico. So something to keep an eye on. But if that arc holds, it means that we might get some relief from our, you know, extremely high new infection rates in Washington State and in King County, maybe by the end of the month. That's a very tentative projection, and I haven't seen any modeling on this because it's so new. But that's potentially very good news that. As opposed to Delta, which was still rampaging months and months after it arrived, Omicron might burn out quickly. So potentially good news, something to keep an eye on.
We're still weeks away locally here from being able to let our guard down.
Yes. You know, keep wearing masks, keep social distancing, keep washing the hands. All the things we learned to do over the past couple of years, we still need to do them. I know it's fatiguing. Believe me, I'm sick of it too. I'm immunocompromised. So, I have to act as though I'm not vaccinated, in terms of just staying away from people as much as I can. No offense, Mike.
None taken.
No. But it does mean I can, you know, use that urine cure if I need to. Disgusting. It's just disgusting. We're also seeing a lot of hotspots around the world, particularly Europe. Also North America. Canada's been hit very badly. The province of Quebec decided this week to enact a tax against people who are not vaccinated. On the theory that, of course, Canada has, you know, public health care that is publicly funded. And so if your taxes pay for health care and you're more likely to need the health care, that's the rationale behind it. Way too much attention has been paid to Djokovic, I think is the name of the tennis player, and his drama in not getting vaccinated in Australia and not being allowed into the country, and he's now being deported again. And he is considered the greatest male tennis player of all time. But he's probably ended his career over this, because once you're deported from Australia, there are plenty of other countries that have similar requirements for vaccination in order to enter or leave. And then the question, have you ever been deported from a country before? Well, yes. That might keep him from playing in a number of different places around the world. That has been kind of interesting, it's not very good for the sport of tennis, because it's like nobody pays attention to tennis until something like this happens. I should say very few people do. So that is the pandemic update for this week and for last week and the week before and so forth. That's where we stand. Keep wearing the mask. Keep social distancing. Regardless of your vaccination status.
All right. Moving on to other national news, starting with the Freedom to Vote Act.
Yeah, which is now the one act in the Senate. The Senate is adjourned until Tuesday, which is after MLK Day weekend. Happy MLK Day. Voter suppression is alive and well. So the Senate will come back on Tuesday. Probably vote down the Freedom to Vote Act. The two Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have said they're going to refuse to lift the filibuster. So then Democrats do not have the votes to pass this, because the Republicans can block it with only 40 votes. And Republicans are united that they do not want people to vote. The Freedom to Vote Act would do a number of things. It would outlaw the voter purges that we've seen over the past couple decades in red states. It would outlaw the gerrymandering congressional districts that we've seen in a number of red states. It would make voter registration more uniform and more accessible. It would make absentee voting more uniform and more accessible. And in fact, we saw a court in Wisconsin rule that state's voter drop boxes were illegal. So it's not entirely, and remember that the U.S. Postal Service still has not been fixed since it was torpedoed by Donald Trump in 2020 because he thought it would help his reelection chances.
Louis DeJoy is still on the still head of that. He's on the
board, he is,
isn't he?
And I do not understand why. I really don't. But anyway, it would do a number of things to make more uniform voting standards in the United States, and to prevent the kind of voter suppression tactics that we're seeing very widely across Republican-run states in the run-up to the midterms later this year. That is why Republicans don't want to pass it, because, it's a strict political calculation that, you know, if everybody can vote, then they're not going to win. And some of them have said that behind closed doors very explicitly. You know, they do not want to promote the idea of people voting. And you know, the way things are going in all these different states, we haven't been covering all the, you know, different piecemeal, voter suppression tactics that are being passed in all these different states. I see them every week, but you know, we have to talk about something else at some point. So, but you know, it really is shaping up where, where the Republicans are removing nonpartisan election boards and putting partisans in their place. In several states, the state legislature is abrogating to itself the right to overturn an election if they don't like the results. I mean, we really are moving toward a system in which only one party can win. Except for, you know, reliably blue states like Washington, where only one party can win. But that actually is a reflection of how people want to vote. You know, we have already seen, just through gerrymandering and voter suppression, you know, I believe it, the figure in the Senate is that the Republicans in the Senate have 50 seats, but they represent 41 million fewer people than the Democrats do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen this consistently because of gerrymandered districts in the House of Representatives where, you know, far more people vote for Democrats, but the Republicans can get more seats. That's how gerrymandering works. So, my fear is that because of this failure and because the Democrats were unable to get that passed, you know, the Republicans are going to control Congress in after the midterms, you know, this time next year. And then they will win the presidency in 2024. And that will be the last free and fair election that the United States has. That is my fear. And I hope I'm wrong about that. But it requires that everybody turn out in all kinds of different parts of the country this fall. So, all right.
We've got just 5 minutes left. January 6th.
Yeah. We're learning more and more about the conspiracy, and it was a conspiracy for January 6th. We found out last week through a report in Politico that six different states, the six battleground states that the Trump campaign targeted, they actually had local people in those states try to submit false election totals to Congress to certify. The National Archives, I forget exactly what the agency was that handles it, caught those forgeries and rejected them. They were forgeries, and they were done in a coordinated way. And the Select Committee of the House of Representatives that's investigating January 6th is looking into, well, who exactly coordinated that? Whose idea was that? Who were they answering to? I think we know the answer to that. You know, it goes all the way to the top. We also saw this week the indictment of the first person, I believe his name was Spencer, the head of the Oath Keepers, who was a, you know, basically a group that wanted, far-right group that wanted civil war, and supported Trump, of course. They provided security in January 6th for Roger Stone and other high-level people in the Trump circle. He was indicted, as were 10 other people, for seditious conspiracy, which is the kind of charges that we had not seen for the first year of this investigation. So that is a significant step, and it tells you that they are trying to flip people, number one, because those are very serious charges. Those can get you, like, decades in prison. So they're trying to flip people, and that they are getting closer and closer to the inner circle of Trump's people with these criminal charges. And, you know, up until now, it's primarily been the dupes who, stormed the Capitol, because they, you know, they wanted to show off their MAGA hats and Confederate flags. But they are starting to get to the planners. We also saw a request for, information and a subpoena for, not a subpoena yet, but that's probably the next step, from Kevin McCarthy, who's the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, who has said he talked to Trump during the Capitol Hill riot. So they're getting closer and closer to the top. The circle is getting smaller and smaller. So it's going to be very interesting to see over the next couple months. The January 6th commission has said that they want to hold public hearings and they want to get a report issued probably by the end of next month. So we'll see how that goes, but it could be very, very interesting. They've talked to hundreds and hundreds of people already.
All right. If you can squeeze it into 1 or 2 minutes, can you touch on the Ukraine?
Yeah, that is a dangerous situation right now, and I'm sorry I didn't leave it more time. We had at least three major developments in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine in the last 48 hours. Thursday night, there was a major cyber attack on Ukraine. A lot of the government sites were down. They were defaced before they went down. So that was one pretext. And of course, we know that, Russia and cyber attacks are nothing new. Then on yesterday morning, our time, there was what the CIA has characterized as a false flag operation on the Black Sea, in which Russians dressed as Ukrainians attacked a Russian vessel. And that apparently is given the pretext, Russia is looking for a pretext to invade. They're trying to create one. And then also the CIA alleged, and this is the CIA, so, you know, they've got some credibility issues as well. Take it with a grain of salt. But, it's certainly believable that Russia has, people in eastern Ukraine, poised to do, again, false flag operations of attacks on Russians at the front, and pro-Russian Ukrainians, in that civil war. So it looks like Russia is looking for a pretext to attack. The United States and Russia had talks in Geneva this week. They have broken down. Both sides are probably farther apart now than when they started. So keep an eye on that. That could blow up in the next week.
Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. So we will have to corral you again same time next week.
We'll do it.